Thanks for coming back again.
Thank you, David, yet again. And thank you especially for the reading from the Dhammapada. I noticed that one of the verses said, be joyful even in the middle of troubled times, something like that, which seemed to fit in quite well. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but fit in quite perfectly with the title for today's talk, which is A Buddhist Teaching for Troubled Times. How's the sound? Is it okay? Great. Troubled times. Am I the only one here who thinks that maybe troubled times might be an understatement? I mean, it really seems to me that we've entered a kind of perfect storm when you put together economics, politics, and of course the ecological. It really does seem to me that a lot of things are falling apart or self-destructing. And I just can't remember a time in my lifetime that's been more urgent, more critical, maybe we can say more dangerous, you know? I mean, certainly during the Cold War, we were only a button away from mutual assured destruction, but the sense we have now is we're sort of just sliding into some critical situation. What am I doing wrong here? Am I? It's in the pocket, yeah. Take it out. Okay, got it.
Let me
sure. Try a different pocket.
Maybe.
Okay. Give it a try. Thanks. Where was I? Gloom and doom, actually, right? Well, I mean, just think about a few things, like our economic situation. In some ways, that might seem one of the better parts, but the truth is, for many, if not most people, there really hasn't been much of recovery since 2008. The banks have recovered, Wall Street has recovered, and that incredible gap between rich and poor, monstrous, is already, you know, it continues to get worse and worse. And I was reminded of this quotation by Justice Brandeis, I think he, probably back in the 30s or something, when he said, we can have democracy in this country or we can have great concentrations of wealth. But we can't have both. And I think we can see which it is at this point and the way things are going, especially after Citizens United ruling, where there's so much more money in politics, which enables a very small number of very wealthy people to have inordinate influence on the country. In the meantime, the levels of indebtedness, think about students and the incredible trillions of dollars that students now graduate with. So, economically, especially this gap between rich and poor, that's pretty scary. Politically, he who must not be named, number one, yeah, not only the most powerful man in our country, but in the world, yeah, and by no means only him. I mean, when you look at the rise of authoritarianism all over the world, right, places like Poland, Austria, Hungary, Turkey, India, China, Russia. I mean, the authoritarianism is truly horrifying. What's going on? It doesn't seem to fit into the liberal or neoliberal progressive story about the world getting better. Yeah, and in some ways, I wonder with this wall and the government shutdown with the Mueller investigation, I wonder if things are coming to a head there. But the truth is, Donald Trump is still, he's still strongly supported by something like 36% of the people. In a way, he's a symptom of something much deeper. It's almost like we're in a kind of cold civil war, cold in the sense that we're not actually shooting each other, but the gap in consciousness, has it ever been so great before, at least since the Civil War, you know? So even if Trump goes out, how is it going to resolve that fundamental So that's kind of scary. And then, ecologically, climate change. Things seem to be getting worse more quickly than anybody expected. And in terms of national and state, well, let's keep it to national and international. I mean, we're going backwards, right? Actually, emissions of CO2 are going up. And really, we need to remember that climate change is just the tip of the iceberg, really. We're talking about a much greater ecological crisis that includes, for example, the sixth great extinction event. E.O. Wilson has predicted that by the end of this century, up to half of all plant and animal species on the Earth could be extinct or so weakened that they will go extinct soon thereafter. I was just reading today about what some people are calling insect apocalypse. Yeah. A biologist went back to his jungle in Puerto Rico and noticed that the number of insects was 95% less than it had been a few years ago when he had studied. So, and we haven't even talked about all the toxic chemicals or plastics and so forth. So, I mean, putting it all together, it seems to me we're in a very special state. Maybe civilization as we know it can't continue indefinitely in this way. Something's going to have to change. And here I'm reminded of one of my favorite comics, Swami Beyondananda, who put it very well, I think, when he said, there's bad news and there's good news. The bad news is that civilization as we know it is coming to an end. And the good news is civilization as we know it is coming to an end. So in one way it's going to be very traumatic. It is traumatic, and yet in another way it's necessary. It's going to open the door to something we don't know exactly how that's going to pan out, right? Anyway, okay, given all of this, where does Buddhism fit in, right? I mean, for many of us, Buddhist teachings and our Buddhist practice is a very important part of our lives. What's the intersection between what I've just said about the situation, the collective situation we seem to be in, and what Buddhist teachings have to offer? And I think that's a really important question. And what I want to talk about this evening is one example of a Buddhist teaching that I think is very relevant. But that's not to deny the fact that many people, many Buddhist practitioners, I think, would deny that there's really that much of an intersection. Understanding Buddhist practice as a kind of, maybe escape is too strong a word, but a refuge, a place to withdraw. And depending how that's understood, I can even agree in the sense that we need the kind of grounding that meditation, for example, can give us when we try to face the kind of, or respond to the kind of challenges that we face today. I mean, I think it's important for that bodhisattvas are not only out there in the world doing what they can, but also they continue their own spiritual practice because they need to do that. Because if we don't have that, it's really so difficult to avoid being ground down, burned out one way or the other. You know? But of course, for some people, for some traditional types of ways of understanding Buddhism, especially in Asia, Buddhism isn't concerned about this world. This is the world of samsara. It's really about an escape. It's about transcending this world. And in a sort of modern way, if we're not careful, I think we can use the practices in a way that reinforces that. What do I mean? Well, my guess is that many of you are like me, that when you read some of the daily news, it can be very discouraging, very depressing, the latest ecological or political events. And so we feel anxious, we feel depressed. But hey, we're meditators, right? So we know what to do. We know to go and face the wall and meditate and to let go of these concerns. And so maybe we can get up half hour, an hour later, and we've let it go, right? Now we can go about our daily lives having repressed or learned, use the practice as a way to kind of cognitively, dissonantly push away the realization of what's going on so that we can just go about our normal lives. And I think that's an important question for all of us, whether we sometimes use the practice in this way, whether it's a way of evading, ignoring what we can see is coming down. And I can certainly understand the attraction, because I suspect all of us are traumatized to some degree. But nonetheless, I think that there's something else in Buddhist teachings that can be really valuable here. But in a way, we have to be a bit creative, because when you go back to the original teachings of the Buddha, and the way the later teachings in various South and East Asian countries, when you go back to these teachings, I mean, obviously they're not going to be talking about late-stage capitalism or the kind of ecological collapse that we seem to be facing now, or well, maybe that's sufficient. The important thing to remember, though, in that context, even though we can't go back and sort of read off from the early texts an understanding of our problem and how we can respond to it, nonetheless, I think there's a couple important things to remember. First of all, from its very beginnings, Buddhism has always emphasized impermanence and insubstantiality, right? Anicca and anatta. That is to say, everything is changing all the time. Nothing has any substance or essence of its own. And interestingly, that applies to Buddhism itself. The way that Buddhism spread throughout Asia, the way that it didn't just impose itself, but when it would go to a new country, a new culture, there would be a kind of interaction so that Buddhism would change the culture, but it would itself be changed. So, for example, the kind of Buddhism that I mostly practice, Zen, the Buddha didn't teach Zen. That's something that evolved in China when Mahayana Buddhism went to China and encountered Taoism, especially. Right? And of course, now Buddhism comes to the modern world, not just a modern world, but a secular world, not just a secular world, but a world, a now global civilization that seems to be self-destructing. This is a new, totally new situation, and yet I think there's such an emphasis on creativity within Buddhism that we can really hope that, or we can see the possibility that Buddhism has within it the resources to respond to this. And that brings me to the second point, which is that Buddhism is a very big tent. I talk a lot about Buddhism, but really there's no such thing. What we have is really Buddhisms, right? Very different teachings in different cultures, such as I just mentioned earlier. And within this big tent, there's a lot of things that I think, if we're willing to be creative and ask the right questions and extrapolate, I think we can see a lot of things in those teachings that are very helpful to our situation today. And it's one of them in particular that I want to talk about. One that I have talked about quite a bit in the past, and I think to this group at least once, I'm struck, for example, by what seems to me very interesting, even profound parallels between what Buddhism says about our individual predicament, the sense of self, the sense of separation, the delusion that I'm inside and you're outside, and the dukkha that goes along with it. And one of the very interesting things would be to ask, well, whether that also applies on a collective scale. For example, can we understand the ecological crisis as a larger collective sense of self, that is to say, our species, our civilization? Do we have a sense of separation from the natural world, from the rest of the biosphere? Can we understand what Buddhism says about our individual dukkha because we feel separate from other people? Is it some of the same thing that applies to our collective situation today in relationship to the biosphere? Sorry, I probably shouldn't have gone there, because that's not really what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is more what Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, identifies as the root of our problem, or one of the ways that Buddhism identifies is the root of our problem. Right? For Buddhism, it's not sin, right? It's dukkha, suffering in the broadest sense of the world. So for Buddhism, it's not all about good versus evil, repentance, salvation. For Buddhism, it's about delusion and wisdom, or ignorance and awakening. That is to say, we suffer, and we cause suffering to other people because there's some fundamental misunderstandings about who we are and what the world is. And when we act on those understandings, we create problems. And in particular, what the Buddha emphasized so much, and this was his distinctive revolutionary interpretation of karma, what the Buddha emphasized was intention, motivation. That what creates karma is not just what we do, but it's the motivations, it's the intentions behind what we do, right? And in particular, in the early teachings, we have a very important teaching about what's sometimes called the three fires, or the three poisons, or the three unwholesome or unskillful, unwholesome motivations, unskillful kinds of actions. So I wonder, are people familiar with these, right? Raga or lobha, that would be craving. Sometimes attachment. What's the second one here? Anyway, the translation would be ill will, sometimes hatred, connected with aggression. Let me check the original. Yeah. Dosha in Pali, or devesha in Sanskrit. So the idea of sort of negativity. And thirdly, moha or delusion. I wonder if you're familiar with some of the Tibetan tankas, especially the Wheel of Life. Anybody seen that? It's a wheel because on the outside you have the five or six realms that we can be reborn into according to our karma. But if you look at the very hub, at the very core of that wheel of life, what do you see? You see a rooster, a snake, and a pig, and they're all sort of interconnected. And basically what they symbolize is, the rooster symbolizes greed, attachment. The snake symbolizes anger, you know, the way it will respond quickly to something that threatens it. And the pig symbolizes delusion, because the pig is a very like unhealthy animal that will just sort of eat anything living and so forth. It sort of doesn't discriminate. Why that's delusion right now isn't clear to me, but it's supposed to refer to that. So this is the real heart of the problem. The wheel of life, why does it go round and round? Because of these three motivations at the core, right? Greed, ill will, and delusion. And of course, they're interconnected. Just like in the picture where I think the different animals are biting each other. So you can see how, for example, if you're strongly attached to something, if you're greedy and you really want something, but somebody comes along and interferes with that, that the temptation is going to be to react negatively, right? And we can even carry that further. There's still within this the kind of fundamental delusion that I'm separate from those other people, and that the way to become happy is to satisfy my desires, to be greedy. So those three fundamental motivations, three poisons or fires, for Buddhism emphasizes these. And what I love about it is that it really amounts to a kind of a naturalistic understanding of our situation. There's no reference to some divinely ordered moral code. The basic Buddhist insight is that when we are motivated, when what we do is motivated by these three poisons, the result tends to be negative. call it bad karma, but we're going to create suffering. We're going to create problematical situations, right? Now, that's kind of straightforward early Buddhist teaching. But here's what I find interesting about it when I try to take it from the earliest teachings, say the Pali Canon, to our situation today. And it seems to me we can actually offer, I don't know whether you want to call it a Buddhist social theory or a Buddhist critique or a Buddhist perspective on what our situation is today, the source of the problem. What I'm suggesting is that I think we can understand the problem that we're facing today as, in fact, the three poisons have been institutionalized. And by institutionalized, that means not only that many people are caught up in them, but they have literally taken on a life of their own. They have been systematized. And basically what I'm trying to say is something like this, that, and this is what I'll spend a little time elaborating. I think that the way that our economic system has developed, it's become institutionalized greed. When you look at certain aspects of our society, you could look at racism, our attitude toward prisoners, our attitude toward undocumented immigrants, but in particular, our militarism, you know, the fact that we are, if measured by the amount of our resources that we put into it, we are by far the most militarized society in the history of the world. And likewise, I think the media, and I don't mean just fake news here, but I just think the way its role in perpetuating a certain kind of consciousness, I think the media, the mainstream media, have become institutionalized delusion, or they are institutionalizing delusion. And I think if we can understand how these three institutionalizations work, it actually gives us a kind of Buddhist approach, a Buddhist way of understanding where things have gone wrong. Does that make any sense? So what I'd like to do is just go ahead and spend a little bit of time talking about these three examples of institutionalizing greed, institutionalizing ill will, and institutionalizing delusion. As a Buddhist social theory, as a Buddhist critique, as a Buddhist way to understand how we've gotten here. Okay, first, institutionalizing greed. Well, if greed means you never have enough, and that's one possible definition, doesn't that describe our economic situation today, right? I mean, consumers never consume enough, but you can also say corporations are never profitable enough, their market share is never big enough, their stock prices are never big enough, and we can make it even larger. I mean, governments tend to think their main concern is to increase GDP, GNP, right? Gross national product, gross domestic project. And that too is never big enough. The point is to keep it growing, and that's what they see as their primary function, because that's supposedly what's going to make people happy or going to make the society work. To which my question is always, why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? One way to understand or look at the economic system, say looking at the heart of it in a certain way, the heart, that is to say, the stock market, it seems to me that's a kind of anonymizing black hole, by which I mean this. On the one side, what do you have? You have investors, millions of investors, and also, you know, mutual funds, corporations, and so forth. And why do they invest? Well, naturally, they do it because they want a return on their investment. They want dividends, they want higher stock prices, and so forth. That's why you do it. But then you throw it in the stock market, and there's a kind of anonymizing effect. And on the other side of that, what you experience is an impersonal but unremitting pressure, which every CEO feels, for responding to this with profitability. You know, the need to be more profitable. And I'm not saying everyone falls to this temptation, but insofar as you can avoid the legalities. Anything, anytime you can externalize any expenses, like if you're a miner, and if you can get away with not cleaning up the rivers or the tailings, if you can somehow get the public to clean, the government to pay for it, or to just people have to accept it, if you can somehow do that, then of course that's going to raise your profit margins, right? So if you think about how that works, what's going on there? It's like, it's not as though the individual people who are doing that are bad people. It's not like the investors are bad people. That's just what you do. If you have some money and you want to, you put it in the stock market because you want it to grow, and that's what everyone hears. And likewise, if you're the CEO, you have to respond to this expectation, this desire for growth, because if you don't, if you can't, you're going to get in trouble. For example, supposing you are the CEO of an oil company, energy company. Let's say Exxon. Let's go to the top here. And supposing you wake up one morning and you've had some kind of awakening and you realize, whoa, what we're doing to the earth is really dangerous, really bad. We're going to have to shift our whole focus toward renewables because otherwise we're going to destroy the earth. Well, what's going to happen to the CEO? Well, the interesting thing about Exxon, of course, is that their whole wealth is that they have control over these vast pools of oil, right? So in a way, they almost can't shift to renewables because this is the source of their power, as it were. And if the CEO tries to do so in a way that's going to reduce profitability, which it probably will, what's going to happen? He's going to lose his job very quickly. Right. And see, this is my point, the impersonality of it. Everyone, you think about the corporation. I remember Chomsky saying the corporation, the only thing less hierarchical or more hierarchical than a corporation is the military. You know, it's like in terms of the way it's, if even the CEO at the top is controlled in this way, if he doesn't have this freedom to change, how much less so for everyone else lower on the pyramid? This is my point about impersonality. We've created a kind of economic system that has to keep growing, and it's not due to the responsibility or the badness. It's not as though people are evil. This is simply what you have to do in order to be successful. And those who don't serve the system won't climb to the top, right? Does that make sense? I mean, I think the point I'm trying to emphasize is the impersonality, that it's not individual greedy people, but somehow the system has become locked in this way. It has to keep growing. And if you understand sort of the way the indebtedness works, if it doesn't keep growing, individual corporations get into a lot of trouble, but also the whole economy tends to have a kind of recession. Right? So that's my first point. Have I persuaded you that our economic system is institutionalized greed? Number two, institutionalized ill will. I mentioned before we could include things like racism. How much that's institutionalized, well, that's another question. The other thing that needs to be brought in here, and I'm not sure it belongs here or if it's in the delusion aspect, but the tribalism, which is to say us versus them, right? And obviously, that's very much connected. It's connected with migrants and the wall. It's going to be connected with prisoners. But certainly, it's going to be very much connected with our military, which, as I said earlier, we need to. And because we don't see military people walking around all the time, it's easy for us to forget the fact, as I said, we are the most militarized nation in human history, right? What is it, $800 billion a year? We're so concerned about continuing to grow. We spend as much in our military in 1 year as like the next 6 or 8 countries combined, right? And yet we don't, and yet we feel like we don't spend enough, or there's always the pushing Congress to spend more. There's another aspect to this with the overseas military installations. My number is a few years old now, but I think it was 2005, we had 737 overseas military installations. 737. And that didn't include the secret ones where rendition, i.e. torture, was taking place. Right? Again, interesting contrast here. I don't have the exact number, but our 737 was, again, totally out of the ballpark compared to any other nation. I think there was some other nation that had something like 20. But just keep it in perspective. It's like our military dominates the world. And where it really gets interesting and very sad, therefore, if you're going to have that much money spent on the military every year, well, guess what? You've got to have an enemy to justify it. And it's very interesting, when the Soviet Union and worldwide communism mostly collapsed around, what is it, 1991 or something, that was a huge problem for the military. And I don't know if you remember then, there was all this talk, oh, there's going to be this huge peace dividend, we're going to be able to, that never materialized, right? In fact, what happened was, and I know this sounds cynical, but we managed to find a new enemy. Terrorism. The war on terror. Already the longest war in our history, and it may never end. How would we know? I mean, and the other interesting thing about it, or good in a very perverse way, it's self-generating, right? You have all these drones now. Drones are nice. You don't have to put soldiers in the field. But the drones, right, they kill people. Well, the people killed, they usually have relatives, right? And maybe they don't like it. Maybe they don't like living in a land where there's constant little things flying overhead and you know at any moment they could destroy you. Maybe they don't appreciate that. Maybe we're actually generating more terrorists in our way of trying to kill them. Can we see this as an example of collective action? Collective ill will, collective aggression? And again, think about generals. I was talking a little bit about a CEO and how powerless they really are to do big shifts. Well, think in the military. You know, as you're rising up the ranks, if somebody doesn't go along with the system, what happens? You know, they fall off the pyramid. That's what it's called. If you don't get promoted at a certain stage, you have to retire. So anyone who would have a different point of view is going to be largely excluded from being able to change things, right? I remember when Obama came into office, one of his promises was he was going to close Guantanamo. Remember that? Not only did he not do it, I wonder if he couldn't do it. I wonder if the military isn't so powerful now that it's really, even a president is very limited, even though he's supposedly the commander in chief. There's all these constraints. Yeah. The other thing is nuclear weapons, just to finish this section. We try to stop other nations from getting nuclear weapons, and we try to get them all to sign the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which, by the way, commits us to reducing and eventually eliminating our own nuclear weapons. Well, how are we doing, folks? As of a few years ago, my data is a couple years old, but I don't know that it's much different. We spend about $18 billion a year to maintain and develop our stockpile of nuclear weapons. But by the way, this comes out of the Energy Department. It's not even paid for by the military. Our stockpile of nuclear weapons today is equivalent to about 150,000 Hiroshima bombs. In other words, the bombs, we don't have that many bombs, but the bombs we have are so much more powerful. You put them all together, it's 150,000 Hiroshima-size bombs. And we continue to do subcritical nuclear tests to improve our nuclear arsenal, right? But think about it a minute. Supposing we use just 2 or 3% of those 150,000, that would end civilization on Earth as we know it. Really. So what's the point of that other 97, 98%? It's like, what's going on? And I'm wondering if there's this kind of psychology where with this kind of aggression and defense, it's just like you have to try to control the world, and yet you can never control it enough to feel secure. So you always need more money in the military, you need more overseas bases, you need more compliant regimes in other countries, you need more powerful nuclear weapons. Is this an example of institutionalized ill will? And finally, let me just say a few words about institutionalized delusion. One way to understand Buddhist teachings about ignorance and awakening is to say that each of us is surrounded by a kind of a bubble that we don't know is there. It's like we see the world, but we see the world through the bubble, which is a kind of a filter. The bubble is our ways of thinking about it, our ways of thinking about ourselves and understanding the world, understanding ourselves in the world, so that we end up living in kind of a fantasy world constructed of our own ideas about who we are and what the world is. This is a bubble. And so awakening would be a kind of pricking of the bubble, or great awakening of the Buddha might be the evaporation, the collapse of the bubble. But here's my point. Today we live not only do we have these individual bubbles, but we also live within a huge collective bubble, which is largely created and maintained by the media. The media inform us what is really going on in the world and what's important about that, and also how to live in the world. And the really interesting thing, we can talk about fake news, for example, but more fundamentally, we have to acknowledge that most of the media are, again, corporations. That is to say, they exist in order to make a profit. And they don't make a profit by informing or educating us, right? They make a profit by finding ways to capture our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder. The bidder, of course, being advertising, right? There was some analogy with, like, fishing. It's like the television program is the worm. The advertisement is the hook. And guess who the fish are, right? I mean, so what does this do? It's one thing to say that they want to capture our attention to sell them things. But what does this presuppose? Doesn't it presuppose a certain understanding? I mean, as part of their message, conscious and unconscious, is that what is the meaning of life? Well, the meaning of life is to buy things if you want to be happy, right? All those advertisements, you don't see people looking glum, you see beautiful people looking so happy. Buy me if you want to be happy like me, right? This whole system encourages us, subliminally as well as consciously, to understand the meaning of our lives in this way. Genuine democracy requires an independent and activist press to expose abuse and discuss political issues. But in the process of becoming mega corporations, they abandon this objectivity. Their main concern, rather, is to do whatever maximizes their profits, which means they're never going to question the fundamental delusion of consumerism. that the way to become happy is that that's going to be an essential part of their message. And let's be honest, to some or lesser degree, all of us tend to incorporate or assimilate that, right? I remember Ivan Illich saying, there are, you know, in this world, there are two types of people. There are two types of slaves. There's the slave of addiction, those of us in the wealthy world who can afford to buy some of these things, and they're the slaves of envy, the poor people, and especially the people in other country. But insofar as this tends to, I mean, isn't this the real religion of the modern world? I mean, if religion teaches you what the world really is, what's important about the world, and how to live in the world, can we say consumerism is the most successful religion of all time? Its proselytizing is unexcelled. It's called advertising. You know, it's winning more converts more quickly than any other religion ever has, right? An important part of genuine education is realizing that many of the things we think are natural and inevitable, and therefore that we should accept, are in fact conditioned. That's a really important part of education, if you think about it. We grow up, we take certain things for granted. Education gives us a different perspective on it, right? The world doesn't need to be the way it is. There are other possibilities. But it seems to me the present role of the media is mostly to foreclose those possibilities by confining our awareness and discussion within very narrow limits. I remember somebody once critiqued a film of, I think it was Hedy Lamarr. They said, you know, she expressed the gamut of emotions from A to B. And in a way, isn't that what the political system and the consumerism and the economic system encourages us, right? It's like, sure, we know there's problems, we know that things need to be, but you know, we just need to fine-tune the system a little bit more. But actually challenging, you know, the grip of consumerism, the grip of this kind of economic system that has to keep growing, you know, they're not going to go that far. The other thing we need to remember is that, I spaced out. I didn't remember it. The other thing to remember is that a lot of the problem here, it just seems to me, is the people who control the present economic and political system, and it's harder to, you know, we're not talking about two systems, so it's really their two sides. The people who control the system are also the ones who benefit the most from the present system. And that's the fundamental idea. But again, it's not simply that they're manipulating us in a really nasty way, although, you know, some of that happens too. There are some nasty people there. But when you've become really, really successful, the world doesn't look that bad, you know? You've been successful. You've, you know, people get what they deserve. Yeah, sure, we got to change some things. But really, So in other words, there's a kind of impersonality built into this too. That the people manipulating here are themselves manipulated. They really believe in it because they have been successful in this. And of course, the other phenomenon we're seeing is more and more really, really, really rich people, they hang out with each other. They don't have a lot of contact anymore with the rest of people or poor people. I'm reminded of something that the Austrian writer Karl Kraus talking about how we can be victims of our own propaganda. He said, how do wars begin? Well, politicians tell lies to journalists, and then they believe what they read in the newspapers. I don't know if it's exactly like, actually, I'm not even sure that fits in, but I think it's quite funny. But again, the idea that there's a kind of impersonality built into this. It's not as though the individual deluded people are doing something, but rather there's a system that they're a part of, that the system tends to control them, right? Okay. I've totally lost track of the time. Could be worse, could be better. So basically, what am I saying here? Trying to pull this together. I think this amounts to, I mean, if we look out at our society and we see institutionalized greed, and Buddhism identifies greed as a source of dukkha, and if we see institutionalized ill will, aggression, tribalism, and Buddhism identifies that as a source of dukkha, and if we have institutionalized delusion in terms of how we are conditioned to understand what our role is, the meaning of life in terms of advertising, if we understand it in that way too, then, as Buddhism says, delusion is a source of dukkha. And it seems to me what this constitutes, as I said at the beginning, it does seem to be a Buddhist perspective, a Buddhist way of analyzing, a Buddhist way of looking at the problem that we face today. And from this, I would conclude with two points. First of all, if greed, ill will, and delusion are a spiritual problem, if individual greed, ill will, delusion are a spiritual problem, what do we say about collective, institutionalized greed, ill will, and delusion? In a way, are we facing, can we understand the problem we face today, the problems we face today is not just economic or political or ecological, but is there a sense in which that's a spiritual challenge as well, requiring this kind of great transformation, larger transformation of our situation? And what I really think this points to, this is my second point, is that just as on the individual Buddhist path, it's important for us to understand and transform our individual greed, ill will, and delusion, so it's just as important for us today to understand and to collectively undertake the task of transforming our institutionalized greed, our institutionalized ill will, and our institutionalized delusion. We can understand this as the real bodhisattva path today. I haven't had an opportunity to say anything about the response to it. Needless to say, that's a big issue. Let me just say briefly that I don't think Buddhism gives us specific answers about what to do, but it has a great deal to tell us about how to do it. That's embedded in the bodhisattva path. I mean, if you just look at institutionalized greed, obviously one of the things we need to do is to reduce the gap between rich and poor, or even more obvious, a national healthcare system, right? I mean, that would seem to be pretty obvious, and I think that fits in with kind of, if the opposite of greed is benevolence or generosity, then the opposite of institutionalized greed would be, you know, institutionalized generosity. Well, national healthcare system, for goodness sake, right? We don't have a healthcare system, we have a healthcare industry. The point of it is to make money, for the insurance companies to make money. That's the point of it. But that's profit-making. That's not about compassion or loving-kindness. Anyway, maybe there'll be an opportunity at another time in the future to continue this and to sort of say what we can about how we might actually respond to this. Okay? Thank you very much for listening.